Hillary Clinton got the win she badly needed, just barely, in Kentucky. Sanders wins easily in Oregon, while tensions within the Democratic Party boil over. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Dennis Goldford of Drake University join us this hour to analyze the latest on the 2016 campaign landscape. I'll also ask them to compare Trump and Sanders' populist positions, look at whether Trump really is expanding the GOP as he claims, and ask what chances remain for a third-party candidate. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, this hour's news. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So glad to have the analysts that we have in the studio today. Donna Hoffman in our Cedar Falls studio, associate professor of political science, also department head of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, so good you could come in today.
Happy to be here, Ben.
Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science and Flansburgh Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines, in our Des Moines studio. Dennis, glad to have you back on.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Donna. I'll note, I joined Donna. I'm also now department chair again.
Department chair. We'll add that to the title there. Thank you very much for updating us, Dennis Goldford. We have so much to get to, and it's amazing that, what is it, just less than a half a year until our November elections. We have this fast and fury coming along, we presume, over the coming weeks and months, but so much to talk about. Let's talk about, let's get right to it. We want to talk a little bit later in the program about the tensions within the Democratic Party boiling over within the last few days. I want to ask you, Donna and Dennis, to compare the populism as put forth by Trump compared to Bernie Sanders, and look at whether Trump is really expanding the GOP, as he has often claimed, and what chances remain for a third-party candidate. We want to reach out to our listeners. Have you join us with your comments, your questions, your observations. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your comment or question. Well, Hillary Clinton got the win she badly needed just barely yesterday in Kentucky, winning by half a percentage point over Bernie Sanders. That was a state she won by 35 percentage points over Barack Obama in 2008. Sanders easily won the Oregon primary. He declared at a raucous rally in California that despite pressure from the Clinton campaign to abandon his quest for the nomination, he would stay in the race until the last ballot is cast.
There are a lot of people out there, many of the pundits and politicians, they say Bernie Sanders should drop out. Well, let me be as clear as I can be. I agree with you. We are in till the last ballot is cast.
Donna Hoffman, what is the significance of yesterday's two more states, their results?
Well, that's kind of it. Two more states have gone, so we're counting down until we get to June 14th. And June 7th is the next date where we have a big glut of states going again. But, you know, nothing much changed in terms of the delegate math here, because that's what really is important. And so, you know, Bernie Sanders can claim to have come really close in Kentucky. He certainly won Oregon. But the delegate math didn't really change. And there's, you know, of course, different ways to look at it. But, you know, if you add the superdelegates into it, Clinton actually got two more delegates out of Kentucky. And again, with the superdelegates, she got one more delegate out of Oregon. And so he's doing well, but he can't make up any ground because remember that the delegates, the Democrats award delegates proportionally. And so coming close and then factoring in those superdelegates, his path to capturing the nomination, to overcoming Hillary Clinton, is so narrow as to be almost infinitesimal.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what are Bernie Sanders' goals at this point, given that his claim to the nomination would seem to be out of reach?
Well, you would hope that he realizes that in terms of delegates, as Donna said, it's highly unlikely he could get the nomination unless, you know, he spent some time saying how unfair it was for the superdelegates not to reflect their states. And yet there's been some comment or some words out of his camp in the past couple of weeks that, you know, maybe he could flip the superdelegates over to him. So, you know, if they serve his interests, they're fine. If they don't, they're not. But absent that occurring, you would have to think that what he wants to do is have much more of an impact on the party platform. And studies suggest that, well, the presidential candidates often ignore party platforms. Bob Dole famously said in 1996 when asked about his, "I haven't read it." But still, they're a reasonably good predictor of what the party, at least in Congress, tries to do. So he might well want to have a greater impact on moving the party platform further in a strongly liberal direction, getting away from the Bill Clinton years. And his goal seems to be to enfranchise as a substantial constituency within the Democratic Party all the people with all the enthusiasm that have been for him thus far.
Mm-hmm. Frustration within the Democratic ranks over the last few days over the party's handling of the primary process. It spilled out this week. Bernie Sanders supporters are lashing out at party leaders, arguing that their candidate has been treated unfairly. We had what happened last week. I don't know if I can accurately summarize it. I'll try it. At the Nevada Democratic Party convention, some Sanders supporters who said Hillary Clinton's backers had subverted the party rules, shouted down some pro-Clinton speakers, sent threatening messages to the state party chairwoman after posting her phone number and address on social media. And then after that, Democratic National Committee chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the minority leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, other leaders demanding an apology, publicly discussing the possibility of violence at the DNC in July. And it doesn't seem, Donna, that Sanders isn't backing down. Let's listen to him here. This is with a direct call to the Democratic Party establishment, up to talking to a fired up crowd in Southern California yesterday night.
Let me also say a word to the leadership of the Democratic Party. And that is that the Democratic Party is going to have to make a very, very profound and important decision. It can do the right thing and open its doors and welcome into the party people who are prepared to fight for real economic and social change.
So, Dennis, what is your take on what's happened over the last few days and this boiling over, as I put it?
Well, it's frustrating always to be seeming to win victories and never getting any closer to the ultimate goal. I mean, we have Hillary Clinton politically bleeding, staggering toward the finish line. And Bernie Sanders seems to match her or beat her in various states, but just can't make up any ground. The real danger for her is what I've called a Hubert Humphrey problem, and Donna will know what I'm referring to. In 1968, and this is not to suggest that the Democratic convention in June will be as disastrous as 1968 was. It's hard to know what could be. But in 1968, of course, Hubert Humphrey narrowly lost to Richard Nixon, and George Wallace ran and got 13.5% of the popular vote in 1968. But some studies were done that suggested that if the campaign had lasted another week or two in November of 68, Humphrey would have won. But he had to spend up so much time trying to win back the support of disaffected liberal Democrats, young Democrats, female Democrats, minority Democrats, you sense a familiarity here, who were so angry at the Democratic establishment and the party machine in 1968 that seemed to engineer Hubert Humphrey's nomination, Humphrey had to spend so much time trying to win back the support he should have had, he didn't have a chance to expand his base and beat Richard Nixon. So Hillary Clinton faces potentially a Hubert Humphrey problem this year if she can't get the Sanders supporters to come along to support her and to keep them from staying home. She's got a huge problem in November.
Mm-hmm. I've heard it also expressed in terms of a parallel to another more recent election, voices saying, could Bernie 2016 become the Nader 2000? Donna, what's your view?
Well, I mean, certainly his voters, his supporters seem to be very disaffected. That's one of the reasons why they're supporting him. And, you know, we heard with that clip that you played that, you know, he's not making nice within the party quite yet. And that's what the party really needs him to do. So if we go back a month ago, we were talking about how the Republican convention could be really raucous. And now we're not talking about that. Now we're talking about the Democratic convention. And, you know, to kind of piggyback on what Dennis was saying about the 68 convention, you know, if we look and that ushered in the era that we're in of nomination politics, I should add here, too. You know, when a party has had an unsettling convention, they've gone on to not do very well in the general election. And so the Republicans seem to be coming together. And you know, the people who might potentially disrupt a Republican convention seem to be saying they're going to stay home at this point. Mm-hmm. The Democratic convention is the one where we potentially have this unsettling. And so it is going to be really important. So Bernie said there, and, you know, I don't expect him to go back on his word that, you know, he's going to stay until the last primary. Well, that's in a couple of weeks, 2 weeks into June. But then you have that June to end of July period in which that's when the party needs to come together. So I think the real question is, what will Sanders do to try to bring his vote followers along with him? Or maybe he does nothing there. And then what will Clinton do to try to bring them into the fold? And that's where the real question is with this new dynamic of what happened in Nevada and with the statement that Sanders had, in which he does condemn violence, but he doesn't apologize. And he certainly says, and you guys really need to fix this thing. You know, you're shutting us out kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the rules that the party set, this goes for both the Republicans and the Democrats, matter. And you have to function within those rules. And Hillary Clinton won the Nevada caucuses. But just like Nevada, like Iowa, we have a caucus/convention method. And so from caucus day to convention day, things can happen. And that is what we have had happening in Nevada. And so you have to understand the rules and you have to understand the process. And saying that, you know, you were cheated is problematic in terms of moving the party in this instance forward to the general election period.
Donna Hoffman with us, along with Dennis Goldford, our political analyst on this Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller of the hour in Grinnell. Susan joins us. Hi, Susan. How do you see this? I think you want to talk specifically about what happened in Nevada.
Yeah, Suzanne. Yeah. I heard that the Clinton folks suspended Robert's Rules of Order, and that they sort of did it before the whole assembly was made, and that there were backroom dealings. And I don't know any of that. I mean, I just heard that, and mm-hmm. I'd like to hear. I think what I hear on the radio is people talking about, you know, the reaction of this person or the reaction of that camp. And I can tell you firsthand from my caucus, I've gone to two caucuses now, I'm going on to state, and in the first level, there was a definite problem. The Hillary people in my caucus jumped the gun. They were not supposed to be wooing the people from O'Malley, and they did so before the clock was ready because we were still counting votes over on our Bernie side. And it's things like that that make people a little upset. And then, you know, going into the regional level, there were, I mean, I was asked to not be next to the door, but there were plenty of people mm-hmm. who were Hillary people. I mean, there is a feeling, and I feel like it's akin to not talking about structural racism. There is a structural problem in that if you look in the rooms, all the who's who of everybody who knows all the rules and how to work them, they're all Hillary people because it's the DNC.
Okay, we got the picture, Susan. Let's let perhaps Dennis can you answer Susan's concerns and her personal experience.
Well, I can't really. I can't confirm or refute what she suggests or what she heard might have gone on in Nevada, or Nevada, I guess they say. But, you know, the difficulty is it's both a virtue and a difficulty. The whole point of the changes to which Donna referred that came out of the 68 convention to open up the party, to allow more participation on the part of especially previously excluded groups, particularly young people, women, and minorities, to open up the party more, if you will, and this is not a derogatory term, to amateurs, has enabled, of course, more people to participate, although not as many did as they expected. But at the same time, when it's amateurs, you have people who may not know how to work rules the right way. And that puts them at a disadvantage with people who know the rules. You saw this on the Republican side with the Cruz campaign, really working those rules with regard to delegates, while the Trump people were happy just to win general primary victories. So details matter. And the difficulty is that if you're not a party professional, you've got a life and you've got things to do. And that may prevent you from getting granular with the details and knowing how to work those when you need them.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder what each of you are watching for as we are just weeks away from the Democratic convention in July. How could this go? What are the possible scenarios, Donna?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody expected over the weekend to have, you know, kind of this raucous state convention in Nevada, which did kind of unsettle things a little bit. And so that's a real question mark in my mind in terms of what's going to happen. So, you know, Sanders has been putting his stock into if the people follow me, the superdelegates will flip. Actually, I saw news this morning that one of his superdelegates, I believe it was from Puerto Rico, went over to the Clinton camp. Because I think this may be the Nevada experience may be the tipping point, because there's been a lot of media, you know, Harry Reid, it's his state, stepped in, talked to Sanders, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as you mentioned, the DNC chair, they may have been pushed to the limit in terms of their patience for the Sanders movement to some respects. But they have to be very careful here because these supporters are very important. But even in the clip you played when Sanders mentioned the party, and Clinton, there's this booing that goes on.
Yes.
And that's really problematic for the party. And so I think you have this tipping point that the leaders might be up against in which there's going to be like enough is enough. Mm-hmm. And we have to come together as a party. The Republicans are doing this behind Donald Trump, basically. And if we don't do that, we're at a disadvantage going into the convention and coming out of the convention. And so what I'm looking for going forward is how the Democratic Party handles this and how, you know, the leaders react to Bernie Sanders and vice versa, and then how the Clinton camp tries to make nice with everybody.
Mm-hmm. And anything to add to what you're looking for, Dennis, to add to what Donna said?
Well, listeners of a certain age may remember the Making of the President series started by Theodore White. The first one, I believe, was 1960 with the Kennedy election. And as he went through various presidential cycles, he talked about the rise of the primaries. Remember, only as of 1968, about a third, roughly, of delegates to the national conventions were chosen by primaries. And by 1972 on, it's something like 75-80% or more of delegates are chosen by primaries. And White compared the combat, the conflict, the campaigns in a primary to a family fight. That is, you're fighting with people with whom you're emotionally close, and therefore they bruise and wound more easily, and it's a lot tougher to get back together afterwards. Mm. So the big concern, again, for Hillary Clinton to avoid the Hubert Humphrey problem is if, in fact, she can finally bring this to a close, can she get Sanders to agree, as he said, that the most important thing is keeping Donald Trump, from his perspective, from being president? And even if Sanders says that, can he get the forces he's unleashed with all their emotions to go along with him and support her?
Mm-hmm. A quick answer to this email from one of our listeners. Tom asks, what are the chances of Bernie still being considered for Hillary's vice president? Donna.
I don't think that's very high. I think it's a better likelihood that maybe she's considering somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who would also be acceptable to the Sanders troops.
And energize the progressive wing.
Right, exactly. And that may be something that she's considering. But I don't really think that Bernie probably even wants to be her VP.
Mm-hmm. As we dovetail into talking about the GOP in this side of the election campaign, something that includes both, let's talk a little bit about Trump's brand of populism, comparing it to Bernie Sanders' brand of populism. Certainly different, very different people, very different campaigns, but both called populists. And Politico commenting this week that Trump seems to be taking a page from Sanders' playbook with a number of things. Willingness to increase the minimum wage now. A suggestion that the wealthy may be paying higher taxes should he become president. Attacking Clinton from the left on national security and Wall Street, and making it clear that his opposition to free trade will be a centerpiece of his general election campaign. Dennis, could these Trump positions woo working-class Democrats in November over to Trump?
It's possible, but let me recall a distinction I've made on the program before between what we can call liberal populism and conservative populism. Populism broadly is the sense that the little guy, the little gal, is getting a raw deal from the government mm-hmm. and the powers that be. Liberal populism says the raw deal is coming from government acting to further the interests of the wealthy and connected, and certainly you hear that from Bernie Sanders. Conservative populism is the view that the little guy, the little gal, is getting a raw deal from government acting in the interests of those people. In other words, the people who are layabouts and lazy and don't really deserve any kind of support, and there's often a racial overtone with conservative populism. So in principle, you know, Trump could attract some of these folks, but you know, Trump is so all over the map and doesn't even complete sentences when he's asked a question. It's hard to know how much he's just spouting off at a given moment and how much is a sustained plan.
Mm-hmm. Donna, I wonder, how do you see Republicans feeling about these positions of Donald Trump, some of which I just named, that are not entirely in line with recent GOP positions?
Well, I mean, Dennis is right. He's squishy. He's all over the place in terms of policy. Can you put a finger on exactly what he wants to do with the minimum wage? I mean, he said that he wouldn't raise it back in November. And then in December, he said the wages were too low. And then, you know, the economy will do so well that we won't even need it. And now he's open to raising it. So I don't know where he stands on that. And the same is true about virtually all of his positions. And I think that makes the Republican Party very uncomfortable. And, you know, for example, he has not yet quite made nice with Paul Ryan. You know, Paul Ryan really is presenting himself as a budget hawk, especially wanting to tackle entitlement spending. Well, one of the things that Trump is saying is we'll never touch Social Security and we'll never touch Medicare. And that's really kind of out of line with some of the things the Republican Party has stood for recently. And so, and especially on foreign policy, I mean, where you have particularly seen some Republicans come out and say, I will vote for Hillary Clinton. Not that I just won't, will stay home or I'll vote for a third party candidate, but I will vote for Hillary Clinton are the foreign policy people.
Mm-hmm. And, and Trump very quickly on foreign policy, what do they disagree with?
You know, the fact that he talks, you know, he talks about talking tough, but he doesn't want to go out nation building. He doesn't want to go out and, you know, advance U.S. interests abroad, but yet we need to be tougher on Iran and we need to be tougher on ISIS.
Not enough of a hawk is what you're
right,
saying.
Right, not enough as a hawk. And they know Hillary Clinton's foreign policy stances, and she's more hawkish than a lot of Democrats are, and they're comfortable with that. They at least know where she stands. Trump has said things about, you know, violating the Geneva Conventions, about, you know, using nuclear weapons that are really profoundly unsettling to serious foreign policy types in the Republican Party. And so there's where you have some people who have actually said, I'll vote for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, we'll come back and continue our discussion of the politics of the last few days. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our political analyst. So glad to have them with us this hour. We're glad to have your participation as well. 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about these claims by Donald Trump that he's expanded the GOP. Has he really? There's some new analysis on this. Now, also, the potential of a third party candidate. Is that still around? When we come back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, two of our regular guests, political analysts on Politics Wednesday, and other days when politics are hot. We can count on them being hot from now until November, that is for sure. So we're chewing over the latest on the political landscape within the last few days, kind of tying it together as this narrative continues in both parties as they march towards naming their nominees and as we look toward the opening of the general election. And let's go to a question from one of our callers who dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hayes is with us from Carroll. Hi, Hayes.
Hello, Ben.
Yeah, go ahead. Shoot. What's on your mind?
Well, I look at the happenings in Nevada with the Democratic primary and the frustrations of Bernie's supporters kind of boiling over, feeling like they've been disenfranchised. And it reminds me almost exactly of what has happened on the Republican side with Donald Trump, where it seems his best quality is the fact that he's not a politician. And then week after week, I hear, your political participants talk and say basically the exact same things that I hear the leaders of the Republican Party and the leaders of the Democratic Party talk about. We got to come together. And that seems to be exactly the opposite thing that Bernie supporters and Trump supporters want. Mm-hmm. And some months ago, I called into the program and kind of said that same type of thing about Donald Trump, that his most appealing attribute to a significant number of people seems to be that he's not a politician. And Donna kind of dismissed that potential offhand. And I'm wondering if what is happening in the Democratic Party with Bernie may have potentially swayed her one way or the other, as okay. conventional wisdom has kind of gone out the window. Mm-hmm. With what people want and don't want from their parties.
It sure has been turned on its head this election cycle. Hayes, thank you very much for your call. And since, Donna, you were named there, respond. Yeah.
No, I don't disagree at all that that's the appeal. So there's a segment of disaffected voters out there, and some of them are Trump supporters, and some of them are Sanders supporters. And they're really activated by this dislike and maybe even hatred of the current situation, but they're coming at it from different angles. So the Bernie supporters are, he's very much tapping into this. The 1% is getting everything. The working person, the middle class is shrinking. The working person's getting shafted. And in some respects, Trump is appealing to with some of that same kind of rhetoric. This gets back to that populist notion that we were talking about earlier, that they're both appealing to this populist segment of the electorate, which is usually very activated by emotion, not so much by reason, by emotion. And they're pushing those emotional buttons. And that's, quite smart strategically, because those people are getting riled up. We've seen violence at Trump rallies. We, had some chairs maybe being thrown in Nevada. So they're very passionate about their support for these outsider candidates. And so that's what's really unusual about 2016, is that you have this group of people in the electorate. Some of them are attracted to Trump, but, earlier they were attracted to Cruz, they were attracted to Ben Carson, they were attracted to Carly Fiorina, what we might term those outsiders. And Sanders would be one of those, even though he's been a longtime elected official, because he's, always called himself a Democratic Socialist and been an independent. And so these outsiders have this particular appeal in this election cycle. And it is, in fact, related to this notion that there's just a lack of trust at the federal level in terms of government. There is a dissatisfaction with the things that aren't getting done in Washington. And so I don't disagree with the caller in terms of, yes, this is a very real phenomenon, and it is very unusual.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the Never Trump movement. U.S. Senator Ben Sasse from our neighboring state, Nebraska, has made a name for himself on the national stage as a leader in the Never Trump Republican faction. Here he is making some comments on February 29th. This is just a day before Super Tuesday.
I think that a lot of the people who want to protest vote to try to scream Washington is broken, they need to recognize that there are a whole bunch of other people who say, if this becomes the David Duke Donald Trump party, there are a lot of us who are out.
Okay. However, Sasse found himself rebuked this past Saturday as delegates at the state Republican convention overwhelmingly passed a resolution opposing Sasse's call for a third candidate. They argued it would only help the Democrats win the White House in November. The delegates went even a step further in making clear they were lining up behind Trump. They roundly rejected a counter-resolution that sought to condemn the presumptive GOP presidential nominee for making degrading comments toward women and minorities. Dennis, what is the status of Never Trump, the movement among conservatives? Has it been smacked down?
Well, they certainly have an uphill battle, and we get to interesting possibilities if they try to run a third-party candidate, as you wanted to talk about, and we'll get to that. But, you know, the Republicans created the conditions for Donald Trump. The Republicans, for years, went after the votes, particularly of white working class voters, especially white working class males. These were the working man, the working women that were supposedly the Democrats' constituency. Until after the 1960s, the Democrats began to be seen more as the party of women and minorities, and you hear that with Hillary Clinton all the time, talking about being a candidate to be concerned about women's issues or minority issues, and they're absolutely and certainly legitimate issues, but a lot of white working class males feel then that she's not talking to them. And Republicans have capitalized on that fact since the so-called Reagan Democrats, if not beforehand, in the 1980 election. But at the same time, there are, while Republicans talk about Democrats as elites and elitists, there are Republican elites, especially intellectual elites and policy elites. These are the people who are the Never Trump movement. They were concerned that he's going to destroy the brand of the party, and they're concerned that he would be a disaster for the country. So some are concerned for partisan reasons, and some have a genuine concern for what they think is the well-being of the country. Is that leaders without followers? That's the problem for them.
Mm-hmm. And Sass has been put forward as a potential third-party candidate. At this point, what are the chances of a third-party candidate coming up and having a chance?
The last time a third party displaced one of the two major parties, first of all, was when the Republicans in the 1850s displaced the Whigs. So it hasn't happened for 160 years. Mm-hmm. Now, third-party candidates have had an impact on an election. 1912, when Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party managed to split the natural Republican constituency and allow Woodrow Wilson, with less than a majority of the popular vote, although he had a majority of the electoral vote, he was able to get in and become president. George Wallace scored electoral votes in, I think, maybe about 45 electoral votes, something like that, in 1968, but didn't deprive Richard Nixon of a majority. So the question is, of course, whether, in fact, a third-party candidate could get electoral votes at all. It's not going to win the popular vote and really wouldn't win the electoral vote per se. But here's where the Machiavellian part comes in. If, in fact, a third-party candidate can get some electoral votes and neither of the other candidates gets a majority, then the election goes to the House, where the House votes by state. Mm. And currently, we don't know what would happen this year, but currently, I think Republicans control 33 state delegations. So Republicans could go ahead and give the presidency not to the person who led. That's what happened to Andrew Jackson in 1824. They gave it to John Quincy Adams, even though he came behind Jackson in electoral votes. They could give it actually to their preferred candidate, which would cause huge disruptions, but that's a possibility.
Mm, interesting. Today also, Senator John McCain, certainly no huge fan of Donald Trump, said that the likelihood of an independent challenger emerging to outflank the presumptive nominee, it's hard to imagine, he said. I think the people have spoken in John McCain's words. And to make his point, McCain recalled the late Representative Mo Udall, a Democrat from Arizona. When Mo Udall lost the 1976 Democratic nomination to Jimmy Carter, McCain recalled today that Mo Udall said, "The people have spoken, the bastards."
Mm-hmm.
So we don't see much of a likelihood of that. Let's talk a little bit about this Trump claim. Donna, if I could ask you to jump in on this. He likes to claim that he created a political movement that has drawn millions and millions of new voters into the Republican Party. But analysis out this week tells us that's perhaps not so true.
Well, and, you know, I think what Trump is, you know, potentially looking at is just the fact that turnout is up in GOP primaries in this particular cycle. And we saw that in Iowa with the caucuses, that the GOP caucuses set a record, but Cruz won those, we should add here as well. And so it is certainly the case that if Trump is going to win, he has to expand the map, the Electoral College map. And so part of that needs to be bringing new voters into the system. But there have been, Politico just recently asked some political scientists to do an analysis of some data. The data here is sketchy because states have different caucus primary, those kinds of things, and exit polls are done in some states, not in other states. And there's a lot of different data, and some of it's available and some of it's not. But nevertheless, to the extent that we've got some data here on some of these contests from Indiana and forward, looking at has Trump succeeded in expanding the electorate, the vast majority they're finding in these states where the analyses have been done of the people who are participating in the GOP primaries and caucuses aren't participating for the first time. They might be new to a primary, but they're not new voters, meaning that we can look at their electoral history and they have voted in general elections before. So he is expanding the primary electorate. There's some evidence to suggest that. But those people are coming from the voting pool already. So he's not expanding the voting pool. He's expanding the primary voting pool. And that's a different calculation. And what he really has to do in terms of the general election to flip some states and to change the electoral map is that he has to bring in new voters. And the analysis so far, and again, this is only a few states and it's sketchy, suggests that that's not really what's happening here. And, you know, I would add that even some of my own research that I've done with Chris Larimer, who also was on this show sometimes, we looked at likely caucus goers in Iowa. And we actually hypothesized that more frequent voters would be less likely to support outsiders like Trump. And we actually put all the outsiders together in this. And we actually found, and this was very true of the Republicans in particular, that the more frequent primary voters in the Republican caucuses were more likely to support the outsider candidate. And so what can we attribute that to in Iowa? In particular, if you think about the Iowa Republican Party, for a period of time, it was taken over by the so-called Liberty faction in the 2012 cycle, the Ron Paul supporters. There's the evangelical faction. Much of the fighting that's been going on in the GOP in Iowa has taken place in primary elections. And so that can kind of help explain that a bit. And so there's some interesting things that are going to be trickling out in terms of data as we get it that will seek to elucidate this claim as to whether Trump or even Sanders, for that matter, is really bringing in new voters or if they're just kind of shifting things around.
Outsider candidates always claim to be able to awaken a sleeping giant. Mm-hmm. I asked Bernie Sanders when I questioned him for a local group at an appearance last fall, how are you going to accomplish all this with Congress, the House certainly likely to stay in Republican hands, and the Democrats in the Senate's a 50-50 chance that it would, at least at the time. He said, oh, we're going to bring these millions of new voters to the electoral process. And Trump's claiming to do the same thing on the Republican side. Ted Cruz claiming to bring in millions and millions of conservative evangelical voters that haven't been voting because nobody's been a true, consistent conservative. They always want to claim that they've got this sleeping giant they're going to awaken. And there are about roughly, the last number I saw, Donna, was 90 million eligible voters that don't vote in presidential elections. You know, 40% of eligible voters or more don't vote in presidential elections. But it's if they're not voting now and haven't been voting, it's awfully hard to bring them in to vote when they have.
So many claims of awakening the sleeping giant, but little evidence
so far.
Okay. You know, and I might add here, you know, if we look back to 2008, you know, Barack Obama, especially with young people, he did activate young people, brought them out in record numbers. But guess what they did in 2010? In a midterm election, which is just as important, I would argue, as a presidential election, they didn't show up. And the Republicans were able to capture the House in that particular election. And then the Obama agenda comes to a grinding halt because they want to make Obama a one-term president. Mm-hmm. And so the vagaries of sometimes voters are very, very difficult to predict. And, you know, that's also what we have going forward, you know, with pollsters trying to predict how is this going to shape up. Polling is also changing as well, because you do want to screen out those people who don't vote. And people lie to pollsters. And there's all kinds of challenges. People don't answer their cell phones anymore. There's all kinds of challenges to polling that make predicting who's going to win in November somewhat problematic today.
Wanted to get to one more thing before our hour ends. It always zooms by so quickly because it's just fascinating to see how this is unfolding. And the twists and turns, unexpected, very much so in this election cycle. Yesterday, House Speaker Paul Ryan said he agrees with a new poll showing that GOP voters trust Donald Trump rather than himself to lead the Republican Party. Here's the exchange, part of it anyway, that happened yesterday in a press conference. A reporter's voice heard first mentioning the poll.
Speaker Ryan, new NBC News poll question. Who do you trust more to lead the Republican Party? Donald Trump, 58, Paul Ryan, 39.
I hope it's Donald Trump. He's getting the nomination. I mean, he should. He's wrapping up the nomination. Good Lord, I hope it is, because the person who's getting the nomination of our party is the person to lead our party.
Okay, so that poll, it's an NBC News SurveyMonkey online poll released yesterday showing that nearly 6 in 10 Republican voters trust Trump and to lead the party. Only 4 in 10 say they have more faith in Ryan, the 2012 vice president nominee, as the party's leader. Is this unusual in any way, Dennis?
Well, it makes me wonder. I'm not as familiar with that poll as perhaps Donnie is. It makes me wonder if it's an actual a random sample, a scientific poll.
Because, I see.
You know, it's like somebody in a local station might say, "Well, call in and give us your opinion,"
right.
And it really it's no more representative than if you just ask people sitting around the station, "What do you think about a particular?"
Okay,
issue?
But to the point of having the House Speaker, the leader of the party. At a national level, say that it's okay if Donald Trump garners more trust than he does.
He's working a game. He's trying to finesse this as well as he can. He wants to. He doesn't want the Republican Party to come to a crashing defeat, particularly below the presidential level. So he's concerned about maintaining Republican turnout and participation. At the same time, of course, he's still not ready to endorse Donald Trump. So he's just trying to thread a very small needle there.
Mm-hmm. Donna, your view on this, but Ryan has repeatedly said he's not going to fake GOP unity after this sort of primary we've had.
Right. And I do think that poll was from SurveyMonkey was an opt-in poll. And so there's some questions about that. But nevertheless, how he positions himself on this issue, you know, he's being very strategic, as Dennis mentioned there. And so, you know, he has disagreed with Trump on a number of things and has even, you know, said he disagrees with Trump on things when Trump, you know, kind of crosses this line. And after their meeting last week, you know, he still hasn't endorsed. And so, you know, I don't think it's unusual that Trump gets a higher number there, because he's also, I mean, there's a name recognition factor here as well. And many people can't name the Speaker of the House. But virtually everybody in the United States can name Donald Trump. And it's not just due to his political campaign. It's due to, you know, the fact that he was a reality television show star before this all started as well, which goes a long way to explaining, you know, some of his poll behavior in the early days when there were 17, 18, 19 Republican candidates in the race, too.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple minutes left in our hour, but you talked about this earlier, Donna, and you were talking about it just now. Pollsters still trying to figure out Donald Trump. What a year it's been for predictions and polls thrown for a loop in this election cycle. Dennis, let me ask you, what are the questions you have about polling up to now and polling until the November election based on what we've experience?
Well, you know, we can know who eligible voters are. We can know who registered voters are. The trick is to go from registered voters to likely voters. Because again, you may be registered, but if you don't show up to vote, what you think doesn't matter. So we go from registered to likely to actual voters. And those two moves from registered to likely and likely to actual, that's the toughest to nail down. That's mm-hmm. where polling has its element of being an art as well as a science.
So when we each evaluate in the morning news, the afternoon news about a poll, you place more stress, more importance if it is likely voters, Dennis, than if it is registered voters.
Oh, absolutely, because the number of registered voters, we know we have very good figures here in Iowa, for example, and we can know how many registered voters show up at a particular election and how many fail to show up, as Donna mentioned, in 2010 at a subsequent election.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, a poll question this time around with Donald Trump in, for instance. Donna, do you think voters will be less likely to admit to pollsters who they intend to support?
Yeah, we could have that. Whereas when pollsters would ask, you know, who are you likely to vote for? And especially we know there's some effects with live interviewers that you might be less likely to admit you're voting for someone who might be outside the norm. And Donald Trump in this case would fit kind of that picture. There's kind of a social desirability effect that sometimes you get in polling. And so, you know, again, there are a lot of challenges with polling, period. And every polling house or every polling shop has a different way that they try to filter out who is a likely voter. Because, again, it's socially desirable to say, yeah, I vote. And so they try to filter that out, and they all do it in different ways. And that's why you have different, you know, numbers coming out sometimes. And, you know, weighting in terms of demographics is part of the art of this as well. And so looking at any one poll is never usually the best way to look at things anyway. There's lots of polling averages that are out there. Mm-hmm. But another thing going into the general election that's important for people to understand is that a lot of times there are national polls done. Is Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump today in the national poll? Well, that doesn't really matter. What matters is not the popular vote. What matters is the Electoral College. State and if you're going state. To look at that, you have to look at those polls state by state. And then when you start talking about polling entities within states, that's even more difficult to do because there are less skilled pollsters sometimes that are doing that.
Mm-hmm. You hear the music? We've got to go, unfortunately. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, where she's department head and associate professor of political science. Dennis Goldford, a department head as well, professor of political science and Flansburg fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. Dennis, Donna, what a pleasure to have you with your insights. I look forward to meeting up with you again.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks, Dennis.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.